This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Dear Maria, I can only apologise for the delay in responding to your letter and poems. I was delighted to hear from a fellow Mancunian. I'm guessing from your address that you live within earshot of the East Lancs Road. I wrote the first poem I cared about in the box room of my gran's house, listening to the roar of that traffic speeding through Salford into Manchester. I've been in a much quieter place this week, up in the lakes, working with an old friend and collaborator. He's a composer, and we've been coming to the same rented house for years when we've got a new work to kick-start. It's icy up here, and there's a blade-sharp wind every morning when I walk down to the water's edge. But we're getting things done. On those walks, I've been mulling over the questions you asked me. They're the same questions I asked when I started writing poems, and if I'm honest, I'm still asking most of them now. I'm glad you've discovered Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. They've clearly made an impression on you, and I'm not surprised. They're full of wisdom. It's always struck me as sad, though, that these private letters, never intended for publication, have outsold his books of poems. You say that you identify with many of the young poet Mr. Kappas's questions, but that you find some of Rilke's answers rather otherworldly. I'm tempted to say that if a German visionary genius can't be otherworldly, then who can? But that wouldn't be fair. His answers to Mr. Kappas's questions seem to be rooted in the practical challenges of trying to fulfil a poetic calling amid the demands of jobs and relationships. Essentially, Kappas wants to know how he can live as a poet in the world, and Rilke tries to help him. Kappas, as you know, was a military cadet when he wrote to Rilke, and you are a trainee journalist. As day jobs go, they seem miles apart, but for both of you the worry is the same, that this career may not serve your deeper vocation as a poet. For what it's worth, I still think don't give up the day job is sound advice. I trained as a journalist too, and then I went into broadcasting, lured by the example of poet broadcasters like Louis McNeice and Paul Muldoon. I don't regret that career for a moment, but I don't think a poet needs a day job in a so-called creative profession. In fact, I'm sure you've read Rilke's advice to avoid what he calls the unreal half-artistic professions, which by pretending to be close to art deny and hurt its very existence. He then writes off the whole of journalism, as well as almost all criticism, and three-quarters of what passes for literature. Well, that does for my former day job, as well as the one you're about to go into. But I wouldn't worry. There is a risk, with any creative job, that it draws on the same pool as your writing, and that something is stolen from your poems. But like many risks, and I'll say more about those later, I think it's probably worth taking. There are plenty of examples on both sides of the day job argument. T.S. Eliot was not just a banker, he was a good and diligent banker, and when Ezra Pound tried to raise funds to rescue him from this unpoetic profession, Eliot wasn't at all sure he wanted to be rescued. Then there's Wallace Stevens, surely one of the most innovative poetic imaginations, and a very successful insurance executive. In fact, he ended up as vice president of the Hartford Accident and Indemnity Company. When he was offered a faculty post at Harvard, he turned it down because it would have meant leaving the insurance trade. So, don't rush to give up the day job. If, at some point, your work demands more of your time and focus, then the day job will give you up. You'll either force yourself out of it through pure frustration and boredom, or you'll be sacked for continued poor performance. Rilke is obsessed with solitude in those letters, isn't he? Solitude as the essential condition of the poet. He's not saying you have to spend 5 years in a lighthouse on a North Sea rock with only the gannets for company, though I suspect he would approve of that. What he's really saying is more diagnosis than prescription. We are alone. That's what he means. We are finally, utterly alone, and if you want to become a poet, then you have to enter the silence within. Remind me not to go for a drink with Rilke next time I'm depressed. But he's right. He talks about the practice of patience and about endurance. Rilke says he learnt from his master, the great sculptor Auguste Rodin, that patience is all. And he elevates this patient attention to the work itself into something like a mystic or contemplative practice. It reminds me of the mystic philosopher Simone Weil and her practice of waiting on God. Does this all sound too purist, too precious? Yes, some of it does to me too. Don't take any notice of Rilke's advice to try to be near to things if there is no fellow feeling between you and other people. By things, he means the dark night sky or the wind in the trees. Things will not abandon you, he says. But this is romantic nonsense. Things will not abandon you because they never had you. Things are sublimely and eternally indifferent to you. They couldn't give a damn about you. Which means we are stuck with people. One of my favourite passages in those letters is when Rilke warns Kappus about the utmost, the ultimate trial and test, the work for which all other work is mere preparation. And what is it? Love. The love between one person and another. Love is full of temptations to trivialise and diffuse it, to render it harmless. Love is full of risk. You asked me in your letter a question so bold, so on the nail, that I honestly don't know how to answer it. Must a poet risk everything for the sake of her work? Well, what can I say? You'll be aware of some notorious and toxic answers to that question. The American poet John Berryman, have you read his dream songs? If not, you should. Said in an interview that he wished all kinds of illness and injury upon himself, anything that didn't kill him, because only through such extremity would he be able to access the great poems. It's a terrible notion, that willed self-destructive impulse that crashes your life and the lives of those around you in the name of poetry. For Berryman, it ended with a suicidal jump from the Washington Bridge in Minneapolis onto the frozen banks of the Mississippi. To what extent did Berryman contrive or create the turmoil he describes in the poems? It's hard to know for sure. He was an alcoholic, and his letters and diaries are full of attempts to turn his life around, to seek help or recovery. But it's hard to reconcile that impulse with a desperate interview in Paris Review, or with the strong sense that the sheer voltage of those dream songs comes from putting everything at stake. In my view, Berryman literally risked his life for poetry and lost it. I wouldn't wish that on any of us. And I do believe it's self-defeating to court suffering and chaos in the name of poetry. I've seen plenty of poets end up losing the poems themselves by doing that. And yet, it's equally hard to dismiss the whole relationship between risk and poetry. To push your work on, to write the best poems you can possibly write, something must be put at risk. It's what screenwriters call jeopardy. If the characters aren't in any jeopardy, the script falls flat. What does that mean? What does it mean for the life of a poet like you or me? Does it mean taking financial risks, giving up everything and hitting the road? Emotional risks, should you fall in and out of love as often as possible? Should you even court physical risk, as some of the First World War poets seem to suggest in their letters, putting themselves in danger for the sake of their work? I can picture you screwing up this letter in frustration as you realise I've failed to answer your most crucial question, except with other questions. All I can say is that you have to find your own risk. Look at two of the greatest English poets, John Donne and George Herbert. At first glance, Donne took all the risks. Prison, public shame, poverty, promiscuity, war, whilst Herbert lived the comfortable life of a country vicar. But in Herbert's poems, the stakes are just as high as Donne's. Can he trust his eternal life to a God who seems distant or brutal, even loveless at times? What are the things that you must put at risk, Maria? As Rilke has it, if you focus on your poems, they will tell you. Let me make one suggestion here that might sound strange. Among the risks you consider, make one the risk of commitment. There's a persistent myth that the artist must resist commitment of any kind to free the imagination. Only the free-floating, free-spirited poet can write the great poems. It was always a pernicious myth, and it still is. Taken with any seriousness, it kills the poems on the page. If the world doesn't matter enough to commit to it, then nor do the poems. Unless you risk committing politically, philosophically, ideologically, and personally, then you have no real investment in the world. Where's the jeopardy there? You will regret, break, and remake some of these commitments over the years, but it means you'll have more of a stake in the world, and your poems will reflect that. Speaking of your poems, many thanks for the sonnet you sent me. You'll recall that when young Kappus sent Rilke his sonnet, the great man simply copied it out in his own hand and sent it back to Kappus without further analysis or critique. He explained that this was a kind of gift, a way of re-presenting the poem to its author as something new, and that seeing it in another person's handwriting would allow Kappus to see it straight, to make his own judgments on its strengths and weaknesses. So, in the same spirit, I've enclosed on a separate sheet my handwritten version of your poem. I've been told that I should have been a doctor, so illegible is my scrawl, but if you can read it, I hope it helps. For me, the best trick to see a poem from a different angle is to ask someone to read it back to you. This takes some nerve, especially if it's someone you don't know that well. It can get you into some strange conversations on buses, but give it a try. It's a way of turning your own poems into strangers, cutting their link with you. That's a risk in itself, but one you should take. Be patient. Hold to the heavy, the difficult, as the great man said. And give the East Lancs Road my love next time you cross the bridge. All my best, Michael.